This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
To restore the soul and secure the future of America requires so much more than words. It requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy, unity.
By temperament,
unity.
By experience, by political leaning, in just about every way, I suppose, other than their age, the last president and our new president are diametrical opposites. It's hard to conceive of two men more different. And with Democrats controlling the White House and the Congress for the first time in over a decade, Joe Biden stands to make a huge imprint on American public life. His challenges are as obvious as they are immense. The pandemic, a botched rollout of the vaccine, a struggling economy, a demoralized federal government stripped of its expertise in many areas, and a deeply divided nation. So where does he begin? The New Yorker's Evan Osnos has followed Joe Biden extensively, and he wrote a biography that came out just before the election. Evan, now we're talking on a Wednesday evening after a very strange and somber inauguration of now President Biden. What struck you about his inaugural address?
I was struck most by the theme of fragility. I mean, this was not a moment for triumph, for, of course, a certain measure of celebration, a sense of relief. But the image that he was projecting out to the country, and it really does also reflect his own life, is this awareness of how easily things can slip away. I mean, he said at one point, we've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. At this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. And you know what struck me, David, about that sentence was, at this hour. It was this kind of acknowledgement of the ephemeral moment that we're enjoying, and indeed there may not be as easy road ahead.
What are the forces that are still aimed at the fragility of democracy?
Well, what Trump both bequeathed to Biden and then also inherited was this underlying disillusion of the things that have bound America together. And it is obviously truth and the kind of collapse of our collective notions of what constitutes a fact. But really, it is also about this list of things that he mentioned. He mentioned opportunity and dignity, and it gets to the nature of economic opportunity and the dignity of work or the lack thereof, and the sense that anybody is truly free when they are contained within the systems of systemic racism and economic inequality. And so what I heard in his message was this, on the one hand, kind of, you know, pacific description of unity that we might be able to achieve if we just want it enough. And just beneath the surface was a pretty harsh landscape of very serious problems that he'll have to contend with on the policy level.
You've written a biography of Joe Biden based on profiles you've done for The New Yorker. You know him, you know his politics, and you know his history, and his history is very various, and it's mediocre in not a few spots. He is now facing challenges that would be daunting to Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln, to any president. What is his capacity to take these things on and succeed?
In a curious way, David, I think he is able to do it now to a degree that he wouldn't have been able to do it 12 years ago, much less 25 years ago. He was, for a very long time, too ambitious to, you know, in his own description, he was too arrogant. And he was a figure that many of us recognized. He was sort of bumptious. He talked too much, and he didn't really cohere around a set of ideas. And as he's gotten older and he's been through tragedies that we know well, he has settled a bit. And he has, I think, become more aware of what you might call the sort of moral center of politics. But Bidenism is not a simple set of policy objectives that we could have described a few years ago or today. It is this actually thing that is more, it's more inchoate. And that's either encouraging if you think that what we're facing is a fundamental moral emergency, or it can be distressing because he's going to now get into the hard calculations of politics. And I think the concern of people who are more progressive than he is that he'll trade away the things that they care about.
For example?
Well, I'll tell you, what I think there is a fear that he will say, we can't make major progress on income inequality without undermining the basic structures of market capitalism. Therefore, we're going to just nibble around the edges. He might be willing to say, I understand that healthcare is so divisive, not only between the parties, but even within the Democratic Party, that I'll put on hold the idea of adding a public option in order to avoid that fight for now. And that, you know, in the end, if you do too many of those cuts, you're eating away at what is the core of the presidency. But I will tell you, though, I'd come away with this. It's with the sense that in a strange way, Biden, who by his nature is a centrist, is not a person who is pursuing transformative change, but he has found himself in this moment in which the need is so clear, so profound, that it has pushed him to be more aggressive, more ambitious than he might otherwise be.
400,000 Americans are now dead of COVID-19. And that number is going to obviously continue to rise. Biden has pledged to administer 100 million coronavirus vaccinations in his first 100 days. Are they really confident that they can do that, that they have a functioning government that can pull this off? That requires going about 384,000 doses per day, what we have now, to a million doses per day.
That actually is not impossible. I mean, this is not my assessment. That's Tony Fauci's assessment. I mean, as a technical matter, if you can actually do what the Trump administration was utterly incapable of doing, which was creating a federal system, a federal response, it's easy to forget just how crazy it really was that the Trump administration never created a full-scale federal vaccination program. It was left to the states. And you know, as people have pointed out recently, as the Biden administration has unveiled its plans for COVID and for the vaccine, there is something frustratingly obvious about the plan. It is not as if it is some elusive science. And I will tell you, the way this connects to this sort of broader question of unity is Biden's view is that the only way that you actually can begin to break down this political uncivil war, as he calls it, is by showing people on the other side that there is some value in what it is you're trying to do. And you take something as unimpeachably necessary as getting vaccines into people's arms. And if you can begin to do that, then you can start in some small way to erode the barrier. That's the strategy. And we'll have to see if it turns out to be true.
So Joe Biden walks into the Oval Office for the first time and sits down and in essence signs 17 executive orders, with more to come. And they range from everything to rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement to extending the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. Now, this is all about undoing the Trump presidency. To what extent can that be accomplished by executive order?
Well, there are things you really can do. I mean, it's quite remarkable the degree to which he is able, I mean, this is the nature of our system, to walk in and with the stroke of a pen, you really can undo the Muslim ban. Now, you can't undo the damage it has caused over the last 4 years. But there's a reason why he believes this, what some people are calling shock and awe approach to doing it, is important. It's sending a message to the public that these things are not permanent. But what I think is interesting is when you talk to the people who are sort of plotting the legislative approach, what they say is there's basically two steps. There's the rescue and then there's the recovery. The rescue is what you have to do immediately, like getting vaccines out, like imposing a mandatory mask policy on federal property and interstate travel. And then there's the hard thing.
The hard thing, that's exactly, well, the hard thing is big legislation, isn't it? And that demands encountering someone named Mitch McConnell. We've heard for years about Joe Biden's belief in politics in the way that Barack Obama found distasteful. Remember Barack Obama saying, "You go get a drink with Mitch McConnell." Joe Biden seems to thrive on that stuff. Is he deluded? How far can he get?
Well, he and Mitch McConnell have a relationship, and that, you know, it is worth both identifying it and then identifying the limits of it. It's worth mentioning that Mitch McConnell was the only Republican senator, after all, who attended the funeral for Beau Biden in 2015. These two have a very long history. And one thing I'm hearing is that they are, in fact, talking quite a bit. They have been in recent weeks. Now, none of that means that Mitch McConnell is going to wake up tomorrow and suddenly be a compliant, enthusiastic promoter of the Democratic Party's interests. But what it means is that there is a basis for communication and a basis for some calculation of the interests of both sides. And that is the core of what Biden basically believes about politics.
In 1861, Abraham Lincoln comes forth and gives his first inaugural address, and it's addressed largely to the South, and it's an appeal for unity, for the country to stay together, the Union to stay together. It's an amazing piece of rhetoric, but it failed. Who does Biden have to reach to keep this country from going mad, from becoming so disunited that it becomes non-functional?
Well, I have to tell you, David, you know, that 1861 address was very much on my mind as I was listening to Biden. I mean, he summoned, as you remember, the words of St. Augustine. He said, "A people are defined as a multitude defined by the common objects of their love." And when I heard that, I thought of Lincoln saying, of course, that he was appealing to Americans' bonds of affection, as he put it, their mystic cords of memory. And 6 weeks later, the Civil War began. So this fragile notion of coherence, of national unity, it's a risky bet. And I think the temptation is to assume, well, Biden needs to somehow reach the people who have been lost to politics, you know, folks who have, the kinds of people who are drifting further and further from, I mean, reality, to be blunt about it. But I think there's another view of this question of the pursuit of unity. And I had a really interesting interview in the days before the inauguration with Reverend William Barber, who is a civil rights leader. He's the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. And he's been talking to Biden off and on for months, actually, because they both believe in this idea of unity, but Barber is fairly hard-boiled about it. And what he said was, look, the Constitution does not call for domestic tranquility. It calls for justice. And what that means is that in order to achieve real unity, that means you have to attack some of the underlying problems in society, and that may cause you more political disunity in the short term.
Joe Biden is 78 years old. He's the oldest person to ever take the oath of office. He's the Ronald Reagan left office at around that age. Now, having covered him for some time, what do you make of concerns about his age? This is not a one-year operation. This is a four-year office and potentially eight.
I think those concerns are valid. There's no fair accounting of what he's dealing with would give you any other answer. Look, the presidency is a uniquely, almost monstrously grueling job. I mean, you took somebody as young and dynamic and fit as Barack Obama, and he walked out with silver hair at the end of it. And the truth is, Joe Biden comes in at a point in his life when most people are not taking on the presidency. But there's another piece of this, which I guess is in his favor, which is he knows this job better than almost anybody who has ever held it before. He worked down the hall for 8 years. He's wanted this for 50 years. And he's also surrounded by people who are very close to him. His wife, his sister, his children, his brothers. There are, and then of course, all the people who are his political aides. So there are people there who will both help him. And then I think, and this is where it's a harder question, there are people around him who will tell him if the moment has arrived and he is done and he shouldn't run again.
You know, it doesn't sound like a difficult job or an impossible job. It sounds like a preposterously difficult job. Do you think he has any second thoughts?
No, because he's wanted this for so long and he believes that it is a decent and worthwhile thing to do. And, you know, I think any of us suddenly contending with the outrageous list of challenges that he's dealing with now might want to just climb back into bed. And I think there's something about this person that is interesting because he never really could have done this job the first time he ran for the presidency and not the second time either. But it just might be that at this point in his life, he's set up to do it.
Evan Osnos, thanks so much.
My pleasure, David.
Evan Osnos is the author of Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. And he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
This election were overturned by mere allegations from the losing side, our democracy would enter a death spiral.
A death spiral. For 4 years, Mitch McConnell aided and abetted nearly every move by Donald Trump. And then, right at the end, he denounced the lies about the election.
We'd never see the whole nation accept an election again. Every 4 years would be a scramble for power at any cost.
McConnell's statement was made all the more dramatic when, in a matter of minutes, the Capitol was overrun by insurrectionists spouting Trump's slogans. McConnell has never been more embattled. He faces a civil war within his own party, and of course he lost the majority in the Senate. Jane Mayer has been reporting on McConnell's tenure as the prime operator in the halls of Congress. Jane, the Trump presidency is over, and yet the Trump show in Washington continues in the form of another impeachment trial. How important is the role of Mitch McConnell going forward?
Oh, he's the most important Republican in Washington at this point, and so very important. And everyone's watching him to see whether he will vote to convict Trump or not in this coming impeachment trial.
And what are the odds? What are his motivations that are going back and forth?
Well, he's in a tough spot, actually, where he has cut a lot of his ties with Trump. He has issued an incredibly forceful, surprisingly forceful repudiation of Trump, basically accusing him of having provoked the mob in the Capitol riot. But at the same time, he has not said whether he will vote to convict Trump.
Okay, this is a very shrewd guy, but we have to ask ourselves, 3 years, 50 weeks. What took you so long?
What took him so long? It was a good deal for him. Basically, there has been an unholy alliance throughout this administration, which is between the Trump base and the corporate wing of the Republican Party, which is Mitch's wing. And neither can really win on their own. You've got maybe 40% of the voters in the Trump base, and you've got that 10% in the corporate wing, but that's where the money is that you need to get reelected. McConnell is fixated on 2022. He wants to get back in the majority, and he must have made the calculation that somehow he'll have a better shot at that if he turns on Trump.
Now, in a speech on the Senate floor, McConnell said this week that the mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. Is it your sense that he's pushing the caucus or simply saying what most of them think?
You know, it's hard to tell, but he seems like he's out in front of his caucus on this. And that's kind of a dangerous spot for a minority or majority leader to be in. I think he was probably genuinely offended and disgusted when his Capitol was invaded by marauders. His wife quit from the Trump cabinet. That's Elaine Chao, who was transportation secretary. And by all accounts, McConnell was very upset with the situation and had enough. But also, McConnell's not really the most emotional kind of guy. I mean, he's a cold-blooded calculator. And Trump, after he lost, couldn't do anything for him anymore. Once they lost those two Senate seats in Georgia, too, it was over. There wasn't much that Trump could do for McConnell.
Now, what Trump did for McConnell over the course of 4 years is provide conservative judges and corporate tax cuts. But in terms of temperament and approach, the two men seem polar opposites. What was the sense that you had of their personal interactions over the last few years?
Well, so first of all, when I was writing about McConnell for the profile, I asked a lot of people, and he was very careful in what he said about Trump. I mean, he plays his cards close to the vest. And now people are coming out, like the Congressman John Yarmuth from Louisville, Kentucky, who's a Democrat and has known McConnell for a long time, came right out and said, basically, McConnell hates Trump and has throughout. And he's confessed this to a few people, but he's been very careful about it.
Now, isn't that a bit convenient to have this kind of information come out at this late date?
Very convenient. And of course, he's looking out for his own reputation, which is to try to disassociate himself from the only president in American history who's been impeached twice, who's facing all kinds of potential criminal complications and potential charges in the future, and whose approval rating is at a record low.
A lot of this narrative has to do with money. A lot of it has to do with Mitch McConnell being very anxious that corporate money is going to be steered away from the Republican Party after the experience of the Trump administration culminating in January 6th. Am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, money is the language that Mitch McConnell speaks. And what happened after January 6th, as Stuart Stevens, a Republican strategist, said to me, was that that McConnell had to be absolutely terrified because huge corporations in America that have been the sort of lifeblood financially for the Republican Party said that they were turning against any of the members of Congress who had spread the election lies that Trump was telling, and they were going to withdraw their contributions. This had to play a big part in why McConnell decided that he had to break with Trump.
Is there going to be a challenge to McConnell as the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate from Hawley or Cruz or Cotton?
Well, he's always worried about that. And by all accounts, he can't stand Cruz. And I don't know exactly what he thinks of Hawley or Cotton. But it was interesting. Cruz was presiding over the Senate during the moment when McConnell gave this the toughest of his denunciations of Trump and of the lies about the election, which Cruz had supported. And it was almost kind of as if he was saying it directly to Cruz as a sort of a shot across the bow.
Didn't it show that McConnell's grip is loosening when Hawley and Cruz and others moved forward the way they did?
It was a challenge to him for sure, because he came out in front of them and said he wanted nobody, none of his caucus, to challenge the Electoral College's certification of Biden's win. And 8 members of his caucus went ahead and did so anyway. This has been the problem for McConnell throughout. The sort of Tea Party wing of the party is not his wing of the party, and he's had a hard time wrangling them. So far, he's stayed, kept them all together, mostly because he's so good at winning, so good at raising money. And so they, while they take these wild stances that defy him, when it comes time, they vote for him.
The new majority leader, the head of the Democrats in the Senate, is Chuck Schumer of New York. How are they going to interact, Schumer and McConnell?
Well, this is going to be interesting. And it's actually already interesting because they've got to divide power. It's a 50-50 Senate, which the Democrats have the upper hand in because they get the vote of the vice president. And so they're trying to work out a power-sharing agreement already. But McConnell's already playing hardball. He's basically saying he's not going to help confirm any of Biden's nominees unless Schumer agrees to give up on the filibuster rule. A number of people on the left are pushing very hard for Schumer to get rid of the filibuster rule. All it would take would be a majority of his members. That is, if all the Democrats voted to get rid of the filibuster rule, they could do it.
But there sits Joe Manchin of West Virginia saying he won't do that.
Right now. Yeah. I mean, wait and see if there's something that he really wants that gets overrun by a Republican vote. I mean, and so basically what Mitch McConnell is doing right now is saying, before there's even a particular piece of legislation at stake, before people's passions are raised over some issue, he wants Schumer to commit to promise not to attack the filibuster rule. And so he's already injected this kind of hardball negotiating position in. So much for unity. I'd say it's not looking good.
No, but Jane, in Machiavellian terms, does Schumer have the same kind of juice, the same kind of skills that McConnell does?
We shall see. They both love to win. Schumer's up for re-election. But really, the thing about the Senate is when you are in the minority, even if it's by one vote, you're in the minority. The person who's the majority leader calls the shots in the Senate. They decide which bills get to the floor. They decide what the schedule is about when they're going to get voted on. It's a tremendous amount of power on whoever has the majority's leader position. So Schumer's really got that. And the question is whether he's going to kind of play the same sort of hardball with McConnell that we know McConnell would play with him.
Joe Biden talks about bipartisanship, compromise. Is he delusional? Is he realistic in thinking he can work with Mitch McConnell?
Well, I mean, it seems like the conventional wisdom in Washington is that because Biden came out of the Senate and for many years worked with McConnell, that they'll have some sort of special magic formula and be able to work together. I'm not so sure. I've read McConnell's memoir, and he kind of makes fun of Biden in it. He describes him as such a talker, such a gas bag, the way he describes Biden. He says, if you ask him what time it is, he'll build you a clock, and tells the story about how they took a flight to North Carolina together to a funeral, and that Biden talked all the way down and then talked all the way back again.
And that may be, he may be a gas bag, but he's now a gas bag who is in the Oval Office. He's got an awful lot of power.
He does. And I think there's a feeling that people looked into the abyss on January 6th and saw what could happen if things got any more polarized and any more ugly in American politics. And so,
what's Mitch McConnell going to do to make it less ugly?
Well, we'll have to see if he works out a decent power sharing agreement with the Democrats on the Hill and really works with Biden. He's made clear in the same speech that he really kicked Trump hard. He also made clear that he regarded Biden's election as a near miss, one where the numbers were close and the country is divided. And he pointed out that Biden said he's going to be a president for everyone. And he said, sort of basically, let's make sure that happens.
So for McConnell, this isn't a change of heart. It's a reordering of his realpolitik, isn't it?
I'd say that puts it pretty perfectly, yeah.
Jane Mayer, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
You can read Jane Mayer on Washington and much more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Simon Parkin writes about technology for the New Yorker. And he was on the show recently to talk about playing video games with his kids during the pandemic. At the same time, he was working on a story from the dawn of the video game age about a game that came out when Simon was barely out of diapers. Simon's partner in telling radio stories is our producer, Alex Barron. So here's Simon and Alex.
Once upon a time,
specifically the early 1980s,
in a far-off land,
Santa Monica, California,
there was a bunch of hippies making video games at a place called Western Tech.
And one of the projects they were working on was a game for the Atari 2600 called Entombed.
In Entombed, you play as an archaeologist who is trying to escape from an underground catacomb.
But this is a video game from the early 80s, so your character is just a little stick figure that you navigate through this blocky maze that scrolls up from the bottom of the screen.
And if you get stuck, then the maze pushes you to the very top of the screen and you die.
Now, the programmers working on Entombed had a big problem.
They didn't want the player to just play the same maze over and over again, because that would be boring. But Atari cartridges had a tiny amount of memory on them, like 2 kilobytes. That's about 1,000 times smaller than a photograph you might take on your mobile phone today. Not nearly enough room to store a bunch of different maze designs.
So they came up with this idea. What if, instead of drawing a bunch of different mazes and trying to fit them all into that tiny bit of memory, what if instead of that, they just wrote some code that could draw mazes? Then you wouldn't have to store all the mazes, you just have to store the code, and it could generate a new maze every time a new game started.
These days, there's a term for this kind of coding. It's called procedural generation, and it's a big deal in video games today.
Like if you've ever played Minecraft, every time you start a new game, it gives you a new map. That map is created with procedural generation.
Here's the problem, though. In the early 80s, nobody really knew how to do this yet. So for weeks and weeks, the programmers on Entombed are banging their heads against this problem. They just can't settle on the right algorithm.
And so, the legend goes, one night, one of these Western tech programmers, these early techies, goes out to a bar and gets super drunk and also super stoned. And he blacks out. And when he wakes up in the morning, he's at home, and he discovers that while he was blacked out, he wrote an algorithm to generate a maze for Entombed. And not only does he not remember how he wrote this algorithm, but he doesn't remember how the algorithm works.
And he checks it, looks it over, and realizes that this really is the solution to the problem they've been looking for.
So in the case of Entombed, we're taking a look at procedural generation and its evolution. You know, this is one of the earlier examples of proc gen use in game code.
This is Andrew Reinhardt. He's an archaeologist, but Andrew doesn't do his digging in ancient burial sites or marketplaces. He does his digging in video games.
First of all, let me explain that I was a trained classical archaeologist. I was a pottery specialist, and you know, I don't know if this will get me into trouble, but I don't see a difference between the archaeology, of a pot that we've gotten out of the ground or of a coin, and the archaeology of a digital artifact. All of these analyses that we might do of games, yields the same kinds of answers about what people were thinking about, what they were doing to entertain themselves, what they were doing to make a living.
Legends like the mysterious maze generation algorithm of Entombed, you know, you hear them more and more. We're maybe 60 years into the digital age now, and the things that happened in the very early days of the digital world are growing kind of mysterious to us. Even when we're talking about early versions of technologies that we still use, like procedural generation, how those technologies came about and why can become sort of shrouded in mystery.
So performing archaeology on digital artifacts like Entombed can help us better understand how we got to where we are right now with technology.
So we decided to do some digital archaeology of our own. Simon and I are keen to try to solve this mystery.
Yeah.
But we are not archaeologists, so we need some help from you to figure out how exactly we go about this.
Yeah, so there's a method to this archaeological
Teach us the method, Andrew.
Teach us the method. Oh, young Jedi. all right, so you have this digital thing in front of you. In this case, it's a video game for the Atari 2600. What do you do? So you can decompile the source code so that you could see what the inscriptional evidence is. How does the code look?
Well,
how is it organized?
We're not computer scientists, so we actually can't decompile the source code.
Fortunately, there's somebody who has already been researching this particular artifact, and he is a computer scientist.
I'm John Acock. I'm an associate professor in computer science at the University of Calgary, and I study old computer games.
John Acock teaches modern computer science students about old games.
And I had never heard of this one before. I didn't know anyone who had ever played it, and I just tripped across and I said, a maze, that might be interesting.
And Acock cracked open the code a bit like an archaeologist rolling back a stone on an actual tomb.
Entombed is written in something called assembly language. It's a very early computer coding language that's very easy for computers to process, but really very hard for human beings to understand.
Back in the 1980s, when people wrote assembly code, they usually included comments within that code, basically plain English sentences that would tell a human what the assembly code did.
But unfortunately, that did not happen with Entombed.
There's no comments, there's no variable names, there's really nothing conveying any information at that stage. And what I have to do is I have to start with that and reconstruct a lot of the meaning as to what was going on in the code.
Eventually, John was able to figure out what the code was doing. Do you want to try and explain this, Alex?
I'll give it a shot. The maze generation algorithm is trying to draw a maze that's challenging enough to keep the player entertained, but isn't actually impossible to solve. And it does that, I guess, by going block by block across the screen and trying to decide if each block should be part of the wall of the maze or part of a path through the maze. Okay, are you with me so far?
Right, I think so. So if I had like a sheet of square paper and I was trying to draw a maze really quickly by coloring in certain blocks and leaving other blocks blank, I can sort of just look at it and see which ones to do for the maze to make sense. Whereas a computer can't actually look at it in that way and is using some sort of mathematical algorithm to figure it all out.
Right, exactly. It's actually taking some data about the maze it's already drawn, plugging it into this algorithm, and then the algorithm makes the call about whether a particular block should be part of the maze wall or part of the path. The problem is that nobody can figure out exactly what the relationship is between the data that goes into the algorithm and the answer that comes out.
The generation of this maze relied on this very odd table in the game, and it was using this to somehow produce this maze. And I was fortunate enough to get in touch with the programmer, and the programmer actually didn't have any idea how it worked either, because it had been something that had been handed off to him.
And it's this programmer who first tells John Acock the story we told you, the saga of the drunken coders in the bar.
There did seem to be an indication that there was some intoxication involved in the production of this code.
The programmer John talked to is a guy named Stephen Sidley.
Good to meet you, Stephen. How are you?
Good, fine, thank you. I just wanted to ask you guys...
Stephen Sidley was a recent UCLA grad when he got hired to work at Western Tech.
The company was full of a bunch of crazed, drunk, and stoned misfit youth, with bare feet and long hair and torn clothes and social awkwardness. And those were the sort of people at the beginning who were interested in video games.
And shortly after he was hired, Western Tech dumped a half-finished game in his lap.
And I was told to pick up and finish a game that they were writing, which was called Maze at the time and eventually was renamed as Entombed. No manuals, no understanding of how the machine worked, nobody sitting around me, total, utter fear.
So Sidley asks one of these hippies around the office where this code that he's working on came from.
And the following story rolls out. The person who had started this game had divined this while drunk and stoned in a Mexican bar drinking tequila one night.
Sidley told John Acock his story, but it was also told to Sidley secondhand, and we wanted a primary source here.
Do you happen to remember the name of the guy who wrote the algorithm?
I want to say Newell, but I may be mixing him up with somebody, so no, I wouldn't fall on my sword about that.
You can sometimes get the feeling that the internet puts like all of the information in the world right at your fingertips, but the internet can also be like the world's largest haystack, and this guy Newell turned out to be a needle.
We find an interview on an Atari fan site from 2008 with a guy called Paul Allen Newell. He does say that he worked on the entombed Maze Generation algorithm. So I have to now join an Atari message board and send a message to the guy who did the interview.
But the only email address he has for Paul Allen Newell is dead.
We can't find him on Facebook or on LinkedIn. He doesn't seem to have a webpage.
So I take his name and this defunct email address we have and just start scouring the internet. And I find that email address pops up a lot on a message board for... Honestly, I'm not actually totally sure what it's for. It's what seems to me to be a bunch of very smart people talking in a very technical way about coding. Eventually, though, I find one post from a few years ago where Paul is complaining about having to change his email address. So I take his name and run it back through the search function on the board to see if anybody else is posting with his name, but from a different address. And that's how I unearth an email I've never seen before. So we cross our fingers and send a message.
When I got the email, first thing I did was I checked up to find out who you were and just to make sure this was for real. And I'm going, oh dear, it is for real.
Paul Allen Newell is retired now. He lives in Southern California.
And like Sidley, he was hired at Western Tech right out of UCLA.
So I was assigned Towering Inferno, which basically is the movie, a video game of the movie. It was one of the first, it may have actually been the first time that a movie sold the rights to make a video game out of it.
Steve McQueen and Paul Newman, Race Against Time.
So Western Tech was making the video game version of Towering Inferno.
The Towering Inferno.
It's out of control. It's coming your way.
And in that game, you play a firefighter who has to rescue people from different floors of this building.
And each floor of the building was a maze. So Paul needed an algorithm that would generate those mazes.
So I and a friend went out one night, had a beer, and I explained the problem. And this is Duncan.
Duncan is Duncan Muirhead, who is a graduate student in maths at UCLA.
He goes, oh, that's no problem. We can just generate an endless maze, and you can take static pictures of it. And so he did the math, and he didn't understand how to code. So I did the code, and together we just dreamed it up over a couple beers and wrote it on bar napkins.
So can you tell me a little bit about what happens? Now you've got these bar napkins. You and Duncan leave the bar and...
I drove Duncan home and I go back to my place. And before I go to bed, I take all that stuff and just dump it into the machine. Very, very rough coding job. So I'm not going to forget anything.
Mm. Now, you know, in the retelling of the story that we've heard, the scene that we're given is that you, as the author of this algorithm, could not remember how you did it, how you did the maths. Is that part of the story true in any way?
No way. No way. First off, partially written by a stoner. I don't smoke weed, okay? Very unlikely that I would have been able to have gotten drunk and whacked out if we're out in a bar, because how would I have gotten home? I coded it up over the weekend. Very unlikely that I've forgotten the thing.
And this is the point when Paul pulls out a big stack of papers.
I have in my hand here the entire thing documented. The whole code, paper printout, none of this electronic stuff that is going to die. Got the whole thing, the maze algorithm, the random number generator that Eichhoff and Copplestone talk about, the whole thing. So that's kind of more like what happened.
Where has that been for the last 40 years? Where have you kept it?
My garage.
Just in a box?
In a box.
To review the bidding, there's no smoking pot, there's no Mexican tequila, there's no blackout,
There's not even entombed at this point.
Yeah. Paul says he wrote the code for a totally different game, and Western Tech repurposed it for Entombed. Okay, so the question remains then, like, how did this legend get started in the first place?
I think what may have happened is either Duncan or I may have used the excuse of forgetting as a way to basically go, we can't provide you with the documentation.
So this really is a story more about intellectual property than about irresponsible drinking. Paul Allen Newell was an employee of Western Tech, so the company owned whatever he made while he was there. But he and Duncan had written the algorithm on their own time. Now they wanted to put their code in the game, but they didn't just want to hand over the keys to their mathematical brilliance.
Right. So remember how we were talking about how programmers would put comments in their code to explain what it did, and the entombed code didn't have those comments when it went to Stephen Sidley? Well, Paul says that that's how he and Duncan protected their IP. They handed over the code, but not the documentation that explained how the code worked.
I think this is where the whacked out of our school and couldn't remember it came in, because I don't think we wanted to tell them, well, we have the documentation, but we're not giving it to you.
It's an explanation that, in retrospect, makes a lot more sense than the legend.
This is classic archaeology in a way.
We went back to Andrew Reinhardt, the actual archaeologist, and we told him what we had dug up.
The fact that they were probably, you know, protecting their IP, you know, by, you know, claiming intoxication during its authorship, you know, fine. You can believe that story. It's easy to believe. You have to take it with a grain of salt. It's like talking to an artist about their art. You're going to get part of the picture, but it's not going to be the whole picture. The best archaeologists will state right up front that this is not 100%. There's always going to be something else to discover. There's always going to be something else to excavate that really adds to the understanding of this particular game, of this particular culture, of these particular people. And, you know, okay, great. So here's another example of that. And it adds to that data that brings us a little closer to that limit of knowledge, you know, that we're always working towards.
Hello, Steve.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing?
Hi, Steve.
So then all that was left was to relate what we found back to Stephen Sidley, who was, after all, the one who we'd all heard the legend of the drunken coder from in the first place.
Over was just the code with no comments.
Ah,
and that
yes.
That's what you
which
would
I was the lucky recipient of.
So does that, like, jive with what you remember?
No, it fits like a glove. Oh, no, I'm tremendously excited by this new twist. I'm going to go tell my wife and my kids about this now. Yeah. That would absolutely be the most reasonable explanation. I just unfortunately got in the way of it, but everything turned out okay.
Simon Parkin contributes to The New Yorker, and Alex Barron is a producer for The Radio Hour. You can find Simon's piece on the best video games of 2020 at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Danny Bonner, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.